Thank you for downloading the latest edition of the Consilio Better Places podcast, in which we have a great discussion with the Deputy Mayor of London for Planning, Jules Pipe, and the Head of the London Plan, Lisa Fairmanner, on what England's regions can learn from the process of creating the London Plan, which is cited in the English Devolution Bill as what regional authorities should look to copy as they produce their plans. I hope you enjoy it, and please subscribe for future episodes. Good morning, Jules and Lisa, and thank you very much for giving up your time today to discuss the London Plan in the context of the government's English Devolution White Paper, which I'm sure will be of considerable interest to local authorities, councillors and people involved in the built environment industry across England. Now, for our non-London-based listeners, Lisa and Jules, can I please ask you to introduce yourselves, explain your background and your current roles with respect to planning in the capital and for London Plan. Lisa?
Hello, I'm Lisa Fairmanner. I'm currently head of the London Plan and Strategic Planning here at the Greater London Authority. I've had lots of roles all in London before and all in the public sector, both inner and outer London at boroughs like Westminster, Newham, Southwark and Kingston. And I've also worked for Government Office for London.
Brilliant, thank you. Lisa and Jules?
Jules Pipe, Deputy Mayor for London for Planning and Regeneration. All my political career has been involved in governance in the capital. I did about 50. Well, I was a councillor for about 4 or 5 years, and then I was the directly elected mayor in Hackney for about 15 years. Last six of those, I was the chair of London Councils, representing all the 32 boroughs and the Corporation of London. And then in 2016, the mayor, current mayor, asked me to join him at City Hall.
Brilliant. Thank you both very much for that. I think our listeners would agree we can't have a more experienced panel to discuss spatial development strategies. So thank you once again for giving up your time today. But firstly, did you know that the London Plan was going to be cited in the Devolution White Paper as the model by which all other authorities should base their spatial development strategies on when they are created?
Well, it's the only one in existence. So I suppose if they had to alight upon a model, then that is the model they have. It's been there 20 years. It's I think matured, you know, it has numerous iterations mm-hmm. throughout that time. Developers, boroughs have an understanding of how it's developed, what it's there to deliver. So it's certainly a sound model for other strategic authorities to learn from and a government to use as a perhaps a straw model to base other spatial strategies on across the country.
At least I'm sure when it was read by a number of local authorities across the country, did your inbox fill up with people saying, can you tell us how to do this?
You'd think, wouldn't you? Yeah. But remarkably not, which is surprising.
Well, maybe this podcast will start the avalanche.
Maybe. I mean, I would say we have had conversations in the past with other authorities looking to do SDSs, and we're always open to having those conversations, and there's no point in reinventing the wheel either.
Yeah. But before we touch on what the London Plan is today, I thought it'd be helpful just to go through the history of planning in London and how we got to today, which is actually more interesting than I've probably made that sound. It appears the first plan for London was the County of London Plan of 1943, developed by the wonderfully named Sir Leslie Patrick Abercrombie and J.H. Fordham, and it was actually prepared in anticipation of World War II ending. This document was then followed in 1944 by the Greater London Plan, which was based around five main issues facing London at the time: population growth, housing, employment and industry, recreation and transport. And here we are, over 80 years later, and it seems you're having to deal with the same challenges. Does the history of previous attempts to solve problems come across your mind when you look to create a strategic overview of planning in London? And do you think on a future podcast in 80 years' time, our successors will be discussing the same five challenges?
Well, first of all, I'd say that anyone interested in planning for London should go back and look at those two documents. I own a copy of both the 43 and the 40 plan, and they are beautiful documents, beautifully produced. They are works of art as historical documents, really, really beautiful. But yeah, essentially, at the heart of strategic planning for London, you know, over all this time, you know, it's about understanding the function of our cities and the context as a global city. And taking that strategic overview of you know, stitching all those myriad parts of London together, and so that's not just simply geographically, but you know, all the servicing of London, you know, the transport that it needs, and you need to take that holistic approach across the whole city.
Mm-hmm. A previous mayor mentioned London's villages, if I remember rightly, but obviously, as you alluded to, there's so much more than that with respect to infrastructure and transport and so on, and knitting all of that together. So following the those two documents, throughout the 50s and 60s, the London County Council created development plans that focused on housing, transport and infrastructure. And there was also the Greater London Development Plan of 73. Now, the GLC, Greater London Council, sorry, was abolished in 1986, which I think is going to be a whole separate podcast on that particular issue. Strategic planning was then overseen by the London Planning Advisory Committee, which I must confess I wasn't aware of, which was comprised of representatives from the various London councils and the city, and was actually serviced by Havering Council up until it was abolished in the GLA Act of 1999. And alongside this, there was Regional Planning Guidance 3, which was issued by the Secretary of State for the Environment in 1996, which sought to provide overarching directives for land use and development within London. Local authorities were required to consider the guidance when formulating their development plans, but it did not possess statutory force. George, I'm sure you'll take this in the spirit it is intended, but I think we can look to you as an elder statesman of local government and planning in London. Before the establishment of the GLA, did the boroughs really have any strategic consideration of planning on a London-wide basis, or was it a bit of a free-for-all?
Well, I think it's important to look at the context of being the 90s, and I think particularly in Inner London, but I think perhaps for London as a whole, there's not a good story to tell about the state of local government generally. It was on a journey. Some were ahead in their journey. Places like Camden came out of those kind of that dark era of the 80s quicker than others. But my own borough, even when we got to the thousands, I know it was a pretty benighted place. And so that period of the 90s, you know, you had a combination of both a lack of oversight quite in the same way, or should we say fragmented. You did, for example, you had LPAC, which, you know, did great work. Nikki Gavron, fantastic policy work, but it perhaps lacked the same framework that we and ability to impose, should I say, that the system has today. Lack of coherence. You also had the Government Office for London as well involved. So perhaps I wouldn't say that it lacked a body of work applied to planning, but it lacked the coherence that we have to now. And then combined with the fact that boroughs were distracted with financial challenges, political challenges. And so I think members on the ground particularly were not, their local plans and how that matched with any other strategic planning focus for London, that was not at the forefront of their minds in the 90s, I don't think.
No, I mean, it was Oasis for me in the 90s, at the forefront of my mind, isn't it? Flashbacks to my teenage years there. But Lisa, from an officer's perspective, do you recall or do you have any views on that particular setup before the GLA came to force? I mean, I guess in many ways it reflects how life currently is for local authorities around England before the new spatial development strategies are going to be established.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think just remembering back to Government Office for London, and, you know, we did comment on local plans, and I remember doing one for Bromley and having a look at and writing back to them. But as Jules rightly points out, there was no coordinating force. So whilst you could give comments back, it wasn't around a common purpose that threaded all of those different places together. And that made a huge difference. I think the other thing from my recollection, rightly or wrongly, was that boroughs in some ways competed against each other. Yes. So, you know, it was a really difficult time economically. And I think there was almost a lowest common denominator. If you negotiated too hard or sought changes on design, another borough would just undercut you. And I think that's a really critical change to how we work now, where it's that, you know, good development in London lifts the whole of London and its economic success. We don't have to compete between boroughs.
And that's really, I guess, takes us neatly into the creation of a London plan, which was introduced for the first time in 2004 under Ken Livingstone, following the creation of the mayoralty in 2000. I'm sure there are many, many differences between the aforementioned RPG3 and the London plan, but pretty clear to me the main difference is it's a statutory development plan, which created binding obligations for local authorities to follow, which, as you both alluded to in your answers, clearly wasn't the case before. But this means it has considerably more power than what came before your GLA. Again, Jules, based on your experience, how did the boroughs at a political level see this? Especially at the time, of course, Kennington would have been an independent rather than a Labour mayor, I think, at the time of 2004. And Lisa, if you were an officer of the borough at the time of the GLA's creation or goal, would you be seeing this as helpful or potentially another layer of bureaucracy that was going to be imposed upon you as an officer at a local authority?
I think the creation of new tiers of, whether it's governance or new tiers of policy, there's always going to be a love-hate relationship between the tiers, both looking down and also looking up. There's, you know, if you're an elected body, you're always going, and certainly having, you know, chaired London Councils for 6 years and been part of it for longer than that, I'm very much aware of the arguments of any governance body to say that, look, we have a legitimacy to set the rules and decide against those rules. We don't really need you to do this for us. Yeah. And I totally accept that. But that's shot through any system anywhere, I think. There's always a strong argument made for devolution, even if there's a very strong argument against that we need a strategic pan-city approach or even a national approach. And, you know, sometimes we at the GLA also often have to wear the fact that there is a national approach that a government wants to impose. Mm-hmm. They have the power to do that, and we need to conform yes. to that. So it's a kind of a healthy sort of equilibrium, and I guess that's the case not just for planning, but any governance process. Is always an argument about devolution versus a coherent, centralised, uniform approach.
Yes, regardless of government, I think that's always the story, isn't it, about we want to give more devolution, and then it's argued about how it happens for the next 5 years of that government. Lisa, again, from an officer's perspective, how do you think the GLA creation impacted how officers went about their work in creating local plans and looking at planning applications, and how much at the start was attention paid to the London plan versus, I guess, today, where an awful lot of attention is paid to it? How was it when it was originally set up?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely agree. It was a lot tenser when it was first set up. And I remember waiting for the letter from the mayor when you've done all the years and years of work getting a plan together, and you just don't know what it's going to say, and it could just blow you out of the water, and really stressful. And I think, you know, as that relationship's evolved, there's no circumstance I could imagine where a local authority mm-hmm. would just get a letter now from the mayor that we wouldn't have talked to them about in advance. They wouldn't know it's coming. And I think, you know, nobody wants to see local plans fall. Nobody wants to see things happen. We're all working really hard in a very strained system. So I think that relationship has really evolved as we've gone through. And I don't think it is another layer of bureaucracy now. And the reason I say that is because London boroughs can look to other authorities outside of London whose local plans have collapsed over housing numbers. Yep. And at least London boroughs can progress their plans, knowing what their housing numbers are, and then just get on with the process of planning for those numbers of homes. Yep. So I think the flip side is such a benefit for London boroughs that it does outweigh any kind of residual kind of concerns about another authority being seen to have a say in your area.
So it feels like the London plan and the relationship with the boroughs has grown over the years, which kind of makes sense. It's a live and learn situation. And I think for people listening, it would be interesting to kind of learn your learnings, if you like, about what has evolved and how you've managed to create this far better relationship with boroughs than what it was when it was originally set. So I think it's probably now the time to ask you what perhaps we should have opened this with. What is the London plan? Why is it needed? And what do you consider have been the main achievements following its introduction? And it's, I think it's important to note that there's been revisions in 2008, 2011, 2013, 2016 and 2021. So it's very much a living, growing document, not just a piece of history of time that Ben Unford has to follow. It does evolve. So, Jules, what is the London plan? Yeah.
Well, I'd just take a moment to take a step back to that period where London didn't have any pan-London governance and the GLC was scrapped. Yes. Everybody of all political parties eventually came round to saying, actually, London does need a strategic voice. Yeah. Whether that was a mayor, whether that was a body again like the GLC, it doesn't matter. It was just, but it was a focus, a figurehead of governance that led the city and stood up and spoke for the city. And the London Plan is the spatial expression of that body's policy intentions. Mm-hmm. Our body that we have now is a mayoralty. And so the London Plan, you know, it brings together all the spatial elements and often is the main levers to deliver all the other strategies that the mayor has, whether that's about transport or environment or health. Mm-hmm. You know, the actual levers to deliver are often to be found in the spatial strategy. And, you know, we've had many successes, I think, over many, many cycles of mayor. You know, I think the strong focus on transport corridors, mm-hmm. and the importance of densifying around transport nodes, yes. I think it's been an essential application that's of the plan, of setting housing targets, obviously, go without saying. You know, the leadership that it gives on opportunity areas, again, was an innovation, and all the carbon and energy related policies that have set the agenda, I think, set the agenda nationally, because, you know, governments have subsequently updated targets and requirements in energy in the wake of, you know, the vanguard of the London Plan targets. So, you know, and also I think was really important is about design quality. Again, I think that's another area where the London Plan, you know, was in the vanguard, and then the government have caught up more recently on design standards and design quality.
So you're now overseeing the London Plan, which, as Jim was alluding to, is quite a responsibility, I guess, because all other policy frameworks seem to flow from the London Plan. What's obviously your long background in local government compared to regional government? What have you found most exciting about the London Plan and working on it and what it can deliver for the city?
Yeah, I think it's just going back to that point as well. We've talked a lot about the boroughs and planning authorities and policy, but this is an actual place. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most important cities in the world. Yes. And we need to be mindful, how is it going to look in the future? How is it going to feel in the future? What happens in different places? It's an actual real place that we're planning for. And I think at the forefront of my mind isn't actually the boroughs or policy or any of those things. It's a genuine place. And what kind of quality of life it can give to people within the parameters that we have. I mean, I didn't write the current plan, but certainly well underway in looking at what the next one will hold. And I think there's a real point about what is universal that is about this city, and that's a space that is so important for the London Plan to occupy. It's not the thing that's happening at local. There's so much for local authorities where they bring their own knowledge and their own flavour, if you like, to their own areas. There are some things that are universal nationally, mm-hmm. but there's a real huge body of staff that sit at that citywide level, that is the starting point, and that it's better to have one examination in public, mm-hmm. and all pulled together as 35 local planning authorities than it is for everybody to fight individually as they go through their own process. I think going forward, we do need to think about, we've got on the one side those relationships with the boroughs, having said it's not just about the boroughs, but on the other side there is a kind of spatial fairness. So very ambitious boroughs come forward and they get a lot of new development, mm-hmm. but sometimes other authorities are not so keen to come forward. But actually, looking at a figure of 88,000 homes a year, all parts of London are going to have to play their part. And I think there's a really critical role for London there as well.
Definitely. You can certainly see the difference in delivery numbers for some, but some authorities are in the thousands, some are in the hundreds, if not less, annually. So having a strategic power to oversee that, it clearly, but to me, it seems a very good thing. But just moving on to the changes to governments looking to bring in, unitary councils are going to be formed. I think the government's guidance is for 500,000 people on average per unitary. And then it's the government seeking to implement a universal system of strategic planning for everywhere in England within the next 5 years. And we certainly can't fault the ambition and the speed at which the government is looking to make these changes. And as we mentioned at the start, the London Plan is highlighted in the devolution bill as the model to follow. And this is going to be a universal requirement, no opt-outs. So where there is already a strategic authority, they'll be responsible for producing a spatial development strategy. And areas without strategic authorities will see the government direct groupings of upper tier counties and unitaries to produce one. So this is coming. There's no avoiding that. Lisa, what advice can you give to planning officers around the country as they begin this journey? I'm sure it's going to be great professional pride in creating a plan like this. Professionally, it must be quite exhilarating to take part in. But it's also probably quite daunting what's going to be coming. Can you kind of explain the process? You mentioned you're reviewing the London Plan at the moment. What is the process that officers should start to thinking about as this comes towards them?
Yeah, I think bringing groups of people together to have quite open conversations has been really beneficial, because we tend to delve straight into policies and into quite concrete things. And we had a really brilliant opportunity over the last couple of years to have much more open conversations right across the board with community groups, with stakeholders, and government type organisations, all in the room together. And going back to that point about place and about which places are going to change the most, where the best opportunities are and which ones are not. So I think that's the first part. I think the second part is just really to nail down exactly what you're intending to achieve. What are those policy areas that you feel are best set at that strategic level? And be really clear about that from the outset in the framing. Because you will, and you do get asked to comment on a lot of matters because they are important, but there is that layer of judgment about where it's best to deal with things. And think from the outset how your plan's going to fit into the other plans. And the other thing I would say is to have an eye on general conformity from the outset. What would non-conformity look like? What would it have to be at a borough level for it to meet that kind of threshold that we've seen come through case law, which is where it actually affects the implementation of the plan overall? And if that's in the background of your mind and helps inform how you move forward and how you frame your policies and your document, I think that will save you a lot of difficulties further down the line.
Just with respect to resourcing, how many people does it take to create a spatial development strategy for a very large area? So I'm just thinking, I think the mayoralty in Manchester is quite well staffed from what I can gather, but in other areas of the country, it's certainly not. It's quite almost a bit of a sticking plaster trying to run to stand still for some authorities. But this is assumedly going to need an awful lot of resource behind it to create the strategy. So how many people do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I have an absolutely amazing professional team of just over 20 people, which may surprise you. And that covers everything, including local plan general conformity, which is three people alone. Wow. But what I would say is we also sit within the wider GLA family. Okay. And for example, the preparation of the document that's coming out in April this year, our next stage of engagement, we drew on over 120 officers from across the GLA family, because they carry their own expertise. And there's no policy team that could carry the level of expertise. I mean, TfL alone. But also, you know, you've got environment team, you've got housing and land colleagues, you've got an infrastructure team, and they all have people who know the absolute detail of this. And that's how we work. We work collaboratively and we draw on that much wider pool of colleagues.
It's quite the undertaking, and it's just from an officer perspective. But I think it's also important to note that the production of a spatial development strategy is not solely in officer-led projects, but I assume must also take into account and lean quite heavily on the political considerations of who the mayor is and the wishes of the manifesto on which they were elected. So do you also think, now to you, I mean, please explain your role in the London Plan, if it's the political appointee, and also the involvement of the mayor in the news of the plan.
Yeah. I mean, it often surprises people to know that actually I'm politically restricted. So I can't engage in politics, publicly at all. But my role is to effectively be the presence of the mayor in discussions with officers in relation to the London Plan, and make sure that the policies of the mayor are finding their way into the direction of travel on the plan as it's produced. And I think that the policy take of the mayor is hugely influential, or has been over the years, hugely influential on the direction of the plan. It would be a mistake for anyone to think, I think, that, you know, because it is so technical, because it involves, absolutely crucially involves, people like Lisa and her team with so much knowledge about planning, and it seems very kind of abstract and technical, people shouldn't underestimate the on the ground impact that it can make once it's in place. And there are all sorts of examples, you know, the degree of density or sparsity that happens in developments, the ease of with which developments come forward and the speed that they come forward, the transport provision that's made in the city, whether it comes forward or not, the speed it comes forward at is absolutely impacted by things in the London Plan. Things that seem good at the time, that technically can be supported, but history has shown perhaps shouldn't have done that. Again, I think illustrates well this kind of huge impact it can have. And the example I would give for that is like industrial land. It'd be very easy to come in as a politician and go, oh, why is all this industrial land there? We're not really using it, you know. Why can't it all be released for housing? And, you know, and we've seen 18% of our industrial land be redesignated since 2001. And yet now we have developers saying, we don't really want any more release because we're struggling to have places for, you know, builders, merchants, for servicing the developments once they're built, you know, the last mile delivery, logistics, data centers, all these, you know. So, you know, that's a very much in a real time sense in the last 20 years shift decisions that people have made, which were political decisions taken at kind of mayoral level, that then the machinery of the officer machinery and the policy machinery and the document itself delivered those changes on the ground. So yeah, people should not make the mistake of thinking that this is just some sort of technical exercise that puts a thick book in the shelf that only planners buried deep in a planning department that will look at, and that they're just a bunch of hurdles that developers have to jump. It really does shape the city.
So it's possibly the strongest power a mayor has got. So in London, I mean, it's, I think it's Boris Kemp. They're known by one name. Everyone knows who you mentioned. So it's quite rare for politicians who have that. And I was just thinking, at government level, it's ministers change every year, give or take. But this is the mayor for 4 to 8 years, or 12 years. It's enormous for them. And it really is the most powerful documents the GLA probably has. Is that fair to say, in terms of how a mayor can leave their legacy, if you like?
I think it is. That when you look at a lot of the strategies that the mayor either has to produce by statute or chooses to produce, a lot of the time the strongest levers to pull to deliver them are the spatial elements within those strategies, and the London Plan is what gives weight to that.
So it's the regional government's kind of lever, if you like. But how much involvement do the London local authorities have in the production of the London Plan? And perhaps a question more for you, Jules, to answer initially. If I randomly sample 5 council leaders in the capital, do you think they would give the same answer to you as you would about how much involvement you may have?
Well, I'm going to leave it to Lisa to be able to give the extensive chapter and verse on the way in which, you know, all sorts of people across the board get an input in the plan. There are multiple points in the production of the plan. But I will answer your question directly, that if boroughs were sampled, certainly politically, I would imagine they would say, you know, harking back to the earlier question, that they would say not enough.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, boroughs understandably do not want to be treated as another stakeholder and a consultee. They always have an ambition. Understandably, I was one of them that wants to be at the table as a joint decision maker. And so the preference of a borough would always be, of a borough leader, is always going to be that, well, I'd like to be at the table with the mayor in adopting. I mean, you know, local plans are adopted. We publish the London plan. It's the equivalent. But they want to be at the table. And that isn't the way the legislation is drawn up. Mm-hmm. And so we are where we are.
Yes.
And so it will always, but in the final analysis, the publication of the plan will appear to politicians, as a local politicians, as quite a top-down process. Yeah. But if we can get past the consultee versus decision-maker argument, in reality, there is endless amount of opportunity to input into what boroughs would like to see.
Liz, from an officer's perspective?
Yeah, I was reflecting, actually. We hosted a session with the leaders and the chairs and vice chairs of planning committees from all the London planning authorities. And it was one of the best events we did.
Right.
And it was so good, because at the end of the day, people want to talk about place, and these are people at officer level and political level who care a lot about places they're responsible for, and they want to be heard and they need to be heard. We've been really clear with the boroughs that there's a different relationship. We know that what we write on the London plan affects them disproportionately, both through general conformity and through their own determination of planning applications. And so we've established a quite different relationship with them through this process we're going through now. We have regular catch-ups. The last catch-up we had just in December with them, we had 113 representatives from the local planning authorities on a call. And we just do those as and when we need to. Boroughs reach out to us very regularly saying, look, we're thinking about this. Can we talk to you? And there's obviously those ongoing relationships we have for those boroughs who are currently in that phase for their local plan. So I would hope that we've got a line that we say that we won't agree. And ultimately, there will be things in the plan that some authorities won't like. But nothing should come as a surprise. And they should have seen an embargoed copy and have time to prepare for things before they land in the public domain. And I think that is a kind of manifestation of the respect, I think, that's built up between our different positions and what we both need to achieve.
Yeah, so going back to how spatial development strategies are created, I guess this goes back to that learning point. I assume what you've described with 100 plus participants, well, we didn't know what Teams was before COVID, but so going back 10 years, that probably didn't happen. And again, this goes to the point that, you know, the London plan used as always is the guidebook. It needs to be not just seen as the words on paper, but actually how you go about creating it and, you know, working in collaboratively with the boroughs or district or unitaries, as it will be, is quite the key thing from an officer perspective.
Yeah, I think so. But also, you know, we're all at different timescales. So if I think about the London plan being drafted in 2017 and then going through the process we went through, the world has moved on in some respects since then, and boroughs are doing such innovative things. So it has to be a two-way conversation. You know, authorities are coming out in their local plans with thinking that update where we were at that time, we can accommodate that. Similarly, they're bringing forward massive development potential in their own areas. Of course, that needs to be captured in the overall spatial plan for London. So, you know, they help us build the content for the London plan because of what they're doing locally.
Yeah, great. Just as we look to kind of bring the discussion to an end, Jules, what would you say firstly to developers and then also future mayors about what they should do to embrace the spatial development strategies that are coming and ensure that both parties get what they want from the process?
I think the key thing is for everyone to understand what the possibilities are. I think it both goes for everyone involved, both the developers that don't operate in London, don't know how it works, and for all those mayors and whatever comes out of the government's thinking on reorganisation, whatever bodies are responsible for and whoever is responsible for bringing these forward, get a common understanding about what the possibilities are. Because, as I say, I think personally that they are huge. You know, what it delivers in terms of coordination of effort, of infrastructure, the priorities that it brings forward, the importance of its role in offering an overarching vision of place. You know, in London, you know, all its neighbourhoods are unique, but London is the world's most important global city, as far as I'm concerned, and so it has to have a unifying vision for the whole of London, and that's not just benefit London in aggregate. It benefits each individual borough that makes up London. What it offers in terms of shifting the dial on major policy issues, and I touch on things like design quality and net zero. I think having that common understanding of the possibilities to excite people and to get everybody working on all those different areas, really be open to it being considered as a joint enterprise, even when it isn't. And this comes back to my point about, you know, just accepting there is a bit of an imbalance there, that there will be an imbalance between decision, you know, as far as who's finally deciding on and adopting the policy, but work in partnership in the build up to that, to share, maximize the sharing of information, accepting that you won't agree on everything.
Yeah, it's interesting. Common understanding, joint enterprise, work in partnership, really is what I took from that, is that how people should approach with this. And Lisa, based on your experience with the London Plan, what are the three main pieces of advice you would give planning officers who at the newly created strategic authorities are about to embark on the journey of creating a spatial development strategy from scratch?
Yeah, I think going back to that point, we can always learn from each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing that could be replaced by putting officer reps on your steering groups. You know, they would have ideas for how to do consultation well. They'll bring whatever group you're putting together, there should be borough reps on it to bring their knowledge and expertise to the table. So in addition to the 120 officers across the GLA family, we also drew on our borough colleagues. And I think that's important. We're all professionals and people have some great ideas out there. I think really thinking how you can add value, and it goes back to Jules's point, where would the boroughs really benefit from a plan? What are the things that we're saying over and over again in our respective plans that actually is a bit tiresome and we could do with just having it at that level? I think there's something that does need to be overcome, which is the concern that if you're at a local authority level and you leave a policy out because it's in the London plan or in outside of London in these new plans, suddenly somebody could review that plan and whip that out from underneath you. And I think that's something to really be addressed early on, because boroughs don't want to have to do work they don't need to do. Of course, yeah. And if there's a policy they can rely on, they'll do it. We're at least in the position with longevity of having policies that have been around for 20 years and they're not going anywhere. But I remember that was a big anxiety when policies were first coming out, that it's all very well if we don't have a policy on design because it's all covered. But then you think, well, that could just be reviewed and gone tomorrow and then we'd have no design policy.
Yeah. So finally from me, Jules, how do you think the process will work when you have a national government of one political persuasion, a mayor of another political colour, and local authorities, or unitary, sorry, underneath from which you're a different colour again? We do a lot of work in Cambridgeshire, and it's not beyond the realms of possibility when all this settles down, we'll have a Labour government, Conservative mayor, and a Dem-controlled unitary council. I mean, getting those three sides to agree, I mean, it's just unbelievable, really. So a huge number of issues I can see there being friction between the three different parties and all playing off against each other. Obviously, you are non-political, as you said, but do you have any advice on how this could be navigated, given it's only since last year that you've had a Labour government, which is probably fair for me to say, it's more friendly towards you than Michael Gove's time as Secretary of State. So it's only recently you've had a more favourable government to deal with. How did you navigate that with a Conservative government and a Labour mayor who had quite different views on things?
Yeah. I think that it's pointless hoping that simply structures and rules are going to deliver the result that you'd want to see, which at the end of the day is good development.
Yeah.
Come forward and come forward at pace, in, you know, fast paced. For me, it's a matter of culture and behaviours. And that is what will unlock cooperation between different tiers, and particularly when those tiers of government are at, of different political persuasions. Yeah. I would say that what I saw over the last 6-8 years mm-hmm. was pretty disgraceful in terms of national government's attitude. I've never seen, you know, I spent 6 years as chair of London Councils, Labour mayor of a borough, worked with the Conservative mayor of London, Boris Johnson, under a Conservative government, and it was civil. There were shared ambitions despite difficult, different political views, and people rubbed along. I think halfway through the last decade, something very badly went wrong, and where national politicians seem to think that they could progress political battles that are that should be left for the campaign trail, continue to pursue those things whilst in government. And I thought that was a pretty disgraceful development for this country for that to happen. I hope and expect that this change of government will bring back more normal relationships between between the national tier, and that goes for civil servants as well, because you know the civil servants, I would say, you know, they are, you know, work on a kind of a cab for hire principle. They have to serve the government of the day, but then that meant that they were also progressing quite a high hostile environment for the tiers of government below them in fulfilling their mandate as civil servants. And I would expect, I hope and expect, that this government will reverse that trend and be very open to working with city governments, regional governments, and local government of any political persuasion to deliver on shared shared agendas. And there can't be a more important shared agenda than housing the population of this country.
Housing and economic growth, you would assume any mayor, regardless of political colour. I used to work at Westminster Council when Sir Simon Milton was leader, and couldn't get a more Conservative council, and yet they worked in wonderful partnership with the Devon government. And it works. It shows it can be done.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I think it can work is because often you've actually got shared outcomes.
Yes.
Invariably shared outcomes. What government of any tier doesn't want to see people housed in decent homes, to see economic growth, to have people jobs, you know, well-educated, in good quality schools? You know, these are universally shared outcomes. But, you know, the debate does come down to the how.
Yes.
The speech, you can do it. Who's paying for it? The overall size, the cost of it. But that should be done in a pragmatic and civil way, those debates and arguments. And then, you know, yes, it would be great with a healthy dose of devolution to be able to deliver those outcomes. Because often I think that the mistake we make on devolution is that people counsel against it because you don't want these like massive variations in outcome. And I think, well, actually, it's not that people are seeking hugely different outcomes, but it's actually some of the outputs and the inputs and the way you deliver services and the way you go about achieving that outcome are different, because the different locations, different people, different populations. And so, yeah, some greater accommodation on that, it would be a good thing. And I think that all that supplies a kind of a rich seam for people to mine in trying to get towards the outcomes that we all share.
Yeah, I mean, the history of a region will shape its plan and its devolution. And I like pragmatism, civility and devolution. Quite a nice way to end up. Do you want the conversation? I hope that's what the rest of England is going to see. And Letha, if anyone wants to get in touch with you to ask your advice on plan formulation, I'm sure that's an open invite to the planning officers around the country.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And me and my team are more than happy to have conversations.
Cool. Letha, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the latest edition of Consilio's Better Places podcast. If you didn't already know, Consilio is the leading built environment communications agency, so make sure you subscribe to future episodes of the podcast to ensure you hear the latest news about all things affecting the built environment in the UK. Thank you.